And so we are entering a new journey in our messages here. We are entering a journey into the New Testament. Now, what we call the New Testament in the early decades and centuries after Jesus' birth was called the New Covenant. It was known as the New Covenant then. But then, of course, you have the rise of Rome embracing the church a few centuries later in the Roman Catholic Church and the Latin translations, and then all of a sudden New Covenant became New Testament. But it was New Covenant before then. Ultimately, it's the Christian scriptures. Or in other words, scriptures means writings. So the Christian writings, or the New Testament as we call it today. We're entering a journey through that section. And as we get started today, we timed it to where we can, that the New Testament begins with the life of Jesus, and particularly early on with the birth of Jesus. So we try to line it up for Christmas that's coming intentionally. So for today and next week, we're going to just get started setting the stage for our long New Testament journey. This Sunday and next, don't miss next Sunday as we set the stage for the whole forthcoming pattern. But today, we're going to do something a bit backwards looking. We're going to look at the New Testament, and it's going to call us back to the Old Testament or the Hebrew story. Because that's how the New Testament starts. If you open your, what we call our Christian writings today, the very first book is the book called Matthew. The first four books of the New Testament are the life of Jesus. The first one in our collection is Matthew, which is his account of the life of Jesus. And Matthew begins his account, the very first verse of the very first page you open up is Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "This is a record of the ancestors of Jesus the Messiah, a descendant of David and Abraham." So Matthew begins with a genealogical record of the ancestry of Jesus, which means he instantly takes us back to the Old Testament or the Hebrew story to start the Jesus story in the New Testament. And so we're going to see this genealogical record pop up here, and we're going to examine it. And by the way, you'll notice that he mentions Abraham here and David. Matthew's going to give us a genealogy that starts with Abraham and moves forward, you know, child after child to Jesus. Whereas in Luke's gospel, he does the opposite. He starts with Jesus and works backwards all the way to Adam from the beginning of Genesis, Adam and Eve. But Matthew starts with Abraham and works forward to Jesus. And so we're going to read a few verses from this genealogical record today. Ready? Look at verse 2. It says, "Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers." And when it says Judah and his brothers, there was a lot of brothers. Remember, Jacob had like two wives, two mistresses, a bunch of kids. 12 brothers, at least one sister. Judah is not the oldest of the children. He's the fourth oldest son, but he's the famous one in the genealogies because it's going to be through his bloodline that the Messiah will be born into the world. Notice anything missing from this verse as we've read through it. Thank you. No women mentioned. I mean, they had a role in this thing, didn't they? I mean, I don't know. The guys didn't do all the work, did they? I mean, you know, seriously, I mean, the guys didn't do almost any of the work. Let's be real, okay? I mean, seriously. Like, they mentioned Abraham. How about Sarah? I mean, I don't know. She's the one who carried Isaac in her belly for 9 glorious months, spit the kid out, you know, painfully later on, and then nursed him. Can't she even get mentioned in the story? Just Abraham, you know, his role in that whole process was really difficult, right? And so, anyhow, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob are mentioned, but not the women. Now, here's the thing. In ancient times, and we've said this before, but we want to remind us that in ancient times, women just didn't have much standing historically. And when it comes to genealogical records, you just wouldn't see them mentioned there. I mean, vestiges of that thinking are still in our culture today, in some parts of the world more than others. But back then, it was definitely the case. I mean, you know, even in our own country, just barely over 100 years ago before women were finally allowed to vote in a democracy here, right? And in ancient times, they before there was any democracy to vote for anybody, they couldn't testify in court because they're women. You know, can't believe their words, you know. I mean, they couldn't own property in many cultures. They basically depended on the guys who had all the namesakes and the everything. And so they're not mentioned here. Now here's the spoiler alert. Matthew, in his genealogical record, is actually going to name four women. And that's kind of very forward thinking, because you're like, why would you put women's names in here? And he does that. And I point that out to make an intentional detour from my main sermon here. I'm taking a detour real quick, okay? And that is this. If you're ever tempted to read the Bible, read the New Testament or the story of Christianity and Jesus and think, oh, it's so backwards and archaic and irrelevant because of our modern day 21st century sensibilities. And if you're not a skeptic looking to find fault, but you're sincerely trying to wrestle that part down, let me just say this to you. Don't think of the Bible 2,000 years ago, or the Christian scriptures 2,000 years ago, through a modern-day lens. Think of it through its current lens back then. In the world in which the New Testament was written, the world was very, what we would think was backwards about several things today. But here's the thing. For the time in which it was written, the Christian writings and the life of Jesus was very progressive on many social issues. Jesus came out and he said, look, I'm going to put down abuse of authority and power. I'm going to lift up the lowly and the oppressed. He says, he dealt with racial issues. He dealt with women's issues over and over again, exalting them in a culture where they weren't exalted. I mean, the Christian story is very progressive for the time. And so when you read it today from a modern Western lens, and look back, and some of you love the archaic part, but others are like, struggle with that. Just remember, at the time, it was very forward-looking, and I believe it influenced where we came to today. In the West especially, all the things we've come to that we call progress were influenced by the Christian influence of the West through the church. And even in a post-Christian society where we kind of push away at our Christian background, that Christian background brought us many of the rights for people that you see today that weren't prevalent back then. And when we read them today, remember that at the time, God was moving things the right direction, even in the epistles, moving things the right way. Now, I say that because he's going to mention four women. Like, why would you mention women here? Well, he's going to mention four. He could have mentioned more, but four is a start. The crazy part is the choice of the women he mentions, because all four women that are mentioned have stories that, if I could be very transparent, they're not very tidy. You're going to see that. Let's begin to read again. The next verse is verse 3. It says, Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. First woman mentioned, Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron was the father of Ram. Now, here's a little spoiler alert for later in the message. The other three women that are mentioned in the genealogies are women whose story we told in the last couple years as we went through our Old Testament journey. We spent time on the other three. We gave each of the other three women a whole Sunday. But we skipped Tamar in that journey. My reason was because it was early in Genesis. It was in Genesis, early in the series. I wasn't sure how fast we were going to go through. I skipped some stories and I ended up slowing it down later on. But the truth is that it was an uncomfortable story. I skipped a few uncomfortable stories early on and then told some very uncomfortable ones later on. So I don't know what that was about. But anyhow, we skipped Tamar's story when we went through Genesis. And we told the other three. So I won't spend much time on the other three. But today I'm going to go back and tell you the story of Tamar, even though we're starting our New Testament journey, because the New Testament starts by mentioning her in the genealogies of Jesus. And we didn't tell that story, so we're going to look back at it today. But warning, awkward. Okay. So anyhow, the story of Tamar takes place in Genesis chapter 38. Now, let me just give you some background before we start reading some verses. Judah is the son of Jacob, the grandson of Isaac, the great-grandson of Abraham. Judah grew up and he married a woman in the Canaanite land there that they lived in, that they believed God was going to give them for their inheritance as a promised land someday. Judah married a woman locally. Now, that was a departure of policy from his ancestors. His father, all his predecessors went back home to where Abraham came from and married women that were more in line with their culture and their kind of their religious backgrounds. And he just says, I'm not going to do that. He marries a Canaanite girl, and they give birth to three boys. And when their kids grew up, the oldest son was old enough to get married, and Judah picks out a wife for his oldest son. Now, I know that most of us Do not love the thought of someone picking out our spouse for us. I would have hated that. I would never do that to my kids, but I know there are cultures where people have chosen the spouse for their kids, and that was sometimes back in those days. He picked a wife for his son. By the way, his son's name was I am not one to make fun of weird names because of mine, but but anyhow, he picked a wife named Tamar. That's where Tamar comes in. The problem was the poor girl was married to a bum. Her husband, was a rotten to the core kind of guy. The Bible describes him as wicked, doesn't say much about him, but does say that God killed him. I don't know what that means. All we know is he was a terrible guy. Poor girl lived with this terrible man, and he died young, and no one missed him. Well, the problem is now she's a widow. Where does she go from here? Because in ancient culture, again, just back to the women's things, they didn't have a lot of rights. Women who were widowed or divorced or even had been assaulted were considered damaged goods. Because all the men back then who had all the power and the control, they wanted a woman that was only theirs ever. She was virgin. She was only theirs ever, only to them. But now the guys could be more open-minded. Many of the men, they had multiple wives for crying out loud. But the wives, they wanted a virgin. So if a woman was been around before, she was often just undesirable for people's situations. So women who were divorced or widowed, they would often go back and move in with their parents and take care of their parents as they got older and survive that way, hopefully get an inheritance later on. Or they would, if they had kids old enough, the kids could help take care of them. And if they were young widows with young kids, that's a tough situation. Some women turned into prostitution because that was a way to make a living amongst the men who were apparently not so concerned about their own purity, but were concerned about the women. They could way to make a living if you're desperate and no one wants you. So it was just a weird world for women. And Tamar is now a widow. What's she going to do? And so at some point, Judah decides he's going to go ahead and have her marry his second son, whose name was Onan. And the idea was this. That in that culture, and you may remember these Bible stories from way back 4,000 years ago, but oftentimes in those cultures, a brother whose brother died, his brother would marry the brother who died's widow in order to give her a child that would be in the deceased brother's name to receive his legacy and his inheritance. And that would be, that basically that would take care of her because then she would be a part of that process. And so so dad says to his second son, who's now old enough to get married, marry your brother's widow and raise up a child in his name. Now, I don't know if that would be his only wife. That would be like his wife and their first child would be in his brother's name and the next would be his own. Or if he would have more than one wife like his grandfather did, by the way, with four, and maybe have his other wife for his own kids. I don't know. But he's supposed to marry Tamar and give her a child, which is for her sake and her, because she's a woman, to give her protection and a sustenance and a child and a legacy in his brother's name. The problem is Onan did not want to do that for his brother. Does anybody want to guess why he didn't want to do it? He didn't want to do it because marrying, so here's the deal. You remember the stories back then, we've told them. When a father would die, he'd give his children portions of his inheritance. But the oldest son would get a double portion of the inheritance. That would have been Ur's. He's dead. If he dies without any children of his own, his double portion would go to his next brother. That's Onan. But by marrying his brother's widow and raising up a child to her, that child would have to go to that child instead of to him. And he doesn't want that. So he decides to take his brother's wife, enjoy her, if you know what I'm saying, as a wife, but not give her a child. So he gets her, they begin to be intimate, but every time before they fulfill the deed, he makes sure not to impregnate her. And that's the tame way of saying it. It's very graphic in the writing. So go home and read it for yourself. It's Genesis 38. If you want a tamer version, read the King James Version. If you want a very plain version, use what we use, which is the NLT, and you'll blush. But anyhow, he basically says, I'm going to get together, I'm going to enjoy my brother's widow, but I'm not going to see it all the way through. And it says that this was a terrible thing to do because that's what she was depending on. And it says that he died. God killed him too, basically. So he's gone. She's a widow again. We pick up the story in verse 11 of Genesis 38. It says, "Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, 'Go back to your parents' home and remain a widow until my son Shelah is old enough to marry you.'" Shelah was too young. Now again, being told as a woman, go back to your parents' house is like a a life sentence. Oh, no. But he knows that. So he says, just until my son's old enough, don't worry. Just hang on to hope. One day we'll call you and we'll carry it on. Now, again, you might be thinking, this is weird. Like, why don't he just give her the inheritance that he would have given to the dead husband and or his children? Just give it to her. Because that's just how the world worked back then for culture. And that's how women felt. So she had to, like, get her medal by having a child, I guess. So he's like, look, we'll bring you in and we'll bring you to the family. And my third son will marry you someday. Go home until then. Because no one else is going to want her. So she does. Here's the problem. It says, but Judah did not really intend to do this because he was afraid that Shelah would also die like his two brothers. He thought that Tamar was what people in more recent days would call a black widow, right? That woman who every bunch she marries just keeps dying. You know, like, you can't marry this girl. It's over for you. It's over, over. And Judah's thinking, what do my two sons have who died have in common? Well, they have you as their father. No, not that. What do they have in common? They both were married to her. So she must be bad luck or cursed. Now, before we give him a hard time for being paranoid, can we understand? Okay, so when I was first pastoring this church, but not in this building, on our old location, I was in my mid-20s back then. And there was a man in our church who was older. He was a senior citizen in his mid-60s. Anyhow, when he was younger, before I knew him, he was married for decades to a woman who died when she turned 58 years old, while she was 58 years old. And he was the same age, and he grieved her. And a few years later, in his early 60s, he remarried another woman who was in her mid-50s, a little younger than him, and found love again. And when she turned 58, she got sick, and she died too. And I was with him in the church, and a couple years later, he's like, man, I'm lonely. I want some companionship. I think I'm going to give it another go. And I said to him one day, tongue-in-cheek, smiling, I said, Clarence, one thing. Make sure whoever you marry next is at least 59 years of age, okay? Because apparently that's been bad luck for you. And he goes, oh, man, I'm going to make sure she's at least 60 years of age because I don't know what the deal is. Yeah. And so it was funny. But it's the same kind of insecurity. Like Judah says, two of my boys have married this woman. They're dead. If I give her the other one and he dies, I got no, it's three strikes and I'm out. So he sends her home under false pretenses. And says, so Tamar went back to live in her father's home. Now, here's a more story without reading it. Years pass by, Shelah grows up. Tamar realizes that no one's calling her, and she begins to lose hope. Meanwhile, Judah himself becomes a widow. Judah's wife dies, and he's heartbroken. He grieves the loss of the woman who he loved and who raised their three sons. Two of them are dead now. She's gone. He grieves. But after he's done grieving, he gets back to living. And all the brothers, this is Joseph's family now, all the brothers, they all are shepherds. And so Judah is a shepherd. And so at certain times of the year, they would bring their sheep to a certain place where they would have the sheep shorn. I hate saying this, it's so hard to say. They would shear the sheep. Say that 10 times fast, okay? They would shear the sheep. And so they would take the wool and they could use it for a lot of purposes to make things. And so it's time to go to the city of Timnah to shear the sheep. I got to say that several times today, don't I? Judah's going to head that way. And that's where we pick up the story about Tamar. It says in verse 14 that Tamar was aware that Shelah had grown up, but no arrangements had been made for her to come and marry him. What's she going to do? She's got no other recourse in that world. So she changed out of her widow's clothing and covered herself with a veil to disguise herself. I just want to spend a few minutes talking about that right there. That makes me cringe. I'm just sorry. I know it's my modern Western sensibilities. But I'm like, wait a minute. She changed out of her widow's clothing. She's been a widow for ages. Like, I understand wearing a season of grief, but Judah has become a more recent widow. He's moving on. Is he wearing widow's clothing? I don't think the guys wore widow's clothing. You know what I'm saying? I mean, she's still wearing widow's clothing. Apparently, that's what she had to wear. It's weird, isn't it? I mean, the cultural things. I mean, is there a store? They go to the store like, hello, ladies. Here's the petite section. Here's the plus sizes. And over there's the widow section. Oh, ma'am, you're on the wrong rack over there. That's non-widow's clothing. I don't know how this goes, but she's wearing widow clothing all these years later, and she decides to take them off one day to go somewhere, and she puts on a veil to disguise herself. And there, she sat beside the road at the entrance to the village of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah, which is where Judah's heading to shear the sheep. I got to say it again. So she's there at this little village on the way. And you know what she's doing? Is she's doing what people did back then. She's sitting outside the village where there's accommodations nearby, and she's putting herself in a prostitution position. That's why the veil is covering her face. Women oftentimes in those days would wear a veil in that line of work because it was very dangerous to be a woman. Prostitution was frowned upon like it often is in culture, but also permissible, and also frowned upon. So if a woman was caught being a prostitute and anyone had a claim to her, they could have her killed for that. So for women to feel safe. Now, of course, men, they could sleep around. I mean, a guy's got to do what a guy's got to do is kind of how the culture's been way too long in history. And so, you know, but she's vulnerable. So women would cover themselves with a veil so that they could protect their identity and maybe be safer. And of course, some men might not want their identity hidden. But then again, if you remove that right from women, maybe they'll have less opportunities. And if you want opportunities, you got to kind of go with the rules, you know? So women would wear a veil, and she's in a spot where it was obvious. Sure enough, it says in verse 15 that Judah noticed her. And he thought she was a prostitute since she had covered her face. In other words, he thought she was just he didn't know who she was. He didn't know that he knew her. He thought, oh, a prostitute. So he stopped, and he propositioned her. Now, it's so cringy because he doesn't know who she is, but she knows who he is. It's cringy. And without reading all the verses, let me tell you kind of how that went down. He's like, how much do you want? And she's like, can you pay me with a goat? Now, I'm not trying to make any jokes about that, but it's very funny to me. Like, I want a goat. That's the payment I want, okay? It's just a funny time. But here's why. They didn't have Venmo and Zelle and Apple Cash, you know. It's like you would give someone livestock that would give you milk if you can milk the goat, or meat, or you can trade it for other things. So it was a bartering form of payment. I want a goat. So he's like, well, that's awesome. Deal. But I don't have a goat with me. So what do we do now? And so she says, well, if you can leave me some collateral. Well, he says, what do you want for collateral? He says, well, I'll take your walking stick and your seal and your cord. Men often wore, men of prominence in business could have a seal that would mark business adventures they would do. They could use that seal to identify themselves in business dealings. It would be worn on a cord around their neck. She says, leave your cord and seal and your walking stick with me. I know you don't want to lose those, so I'm pretty sure you'll come back with my goat. So if you'll give me those for the meantime, that's good enough. He's okay. And so he did. And they did, anyhow, and then they went their separate ways. And Judah goes to shear the sheep, and she goes home to her parents. And after he goes and gets his business done, Judah's like, he tells his trusted servant, hey, guy, I kind of saw a prostitute on the way over here. I owe her a goat, but I don't want to go bring it to her because I've already exposed myself enough. I'm a kind of a prominent man. People know who I am. Listen, could you take the goat to her, get my walking stick and my signet and get my stuff back? Yeah. So he goes to the place where she was, and there's no one there. He goes into the village nearby, and they're like, there's no prostitute by the road over there normally. Maybe it was a passerby. I don't know. So he goes back to Judah and says, there's no one there. Should I look for her? Should I dig deeper? And Judah's like, no. The more we dig, the more it brings attention to what I did. And I don't want attention on what I did. So let's not dig. So let's just do this instead. Let's just let her have my stuff. I'll get a new seal, a new cord, and a new walking stick. We tried, oh well. And everyone went back to business as usual. For a few months, anyhow. It says in verse number 24, about 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has acted like a prostitute, and now because of this, she's pregnant. Now, I don't know how they knew she was acting like a prostitute. I guess because she wasn't doing it, it wasn't with Shelah, his other son. And who's the guy? So if there's no guy, she must have been a prostitute. So they tell this to Judah, and look at his reaction. He says, bring her out and let her be burned, Judah demanded. Wow, the hypocrisy is rank. Like, let her be burned. Now, Judah's trying to kill two birds with one stone. He's trying to have two wins. First of all, by taking the moral high ground, can you believe society today? He can try to distance himself from any idea that he would have engaged in such behavior. You know, if you do something, just at least be real loud against it so people don't think. How many people under the guise of religion have been real loud about the ills of society with their own secret sins, right? So he's all loud and proud. Oh, bring her out. Let her be burned. It's terrible, I say. But also, by the way, poor girl, she's with her parents, but he feels he has right to bring her out as a man of importance and stature, and because she belonged to his sons who are dead and supposed to be the other son, so he has a right to pull her out of her parents' house and have her killed. But here's the thing. It solves another problem for him. If she deserves to die for what she did, he don't have to give her to his other son who might die because she's unlucky. Problem solved. All right, you know. So he says, bring her out and let her be not just killed, burned, like at the stake, folks. This is crazy. Well, anyhow, but as they were taking her out to kill her, she sent this message to her father-in-law. The man who owns these things made me pregnant. Look closely. Whose seal and cord and walking stick are these? I'm picturing how the story went down. She's like, guys, before you take me away, I know, burn me. Bring these goodies to Judah and tell him, hey, good news. I know who the father is because I'm sure that Judah is a moral, righteous, outraged man will want to put a second stake up to burn that guy along with me, and I know how to find him. This is his stuff. And Judah's like, oh. Judah recognized them immediately and said, she is more righteous than I am because I did not arrange for her to marry my son Shelah. That's a good point, but let me just say, notice that a minute ago she was wicked and deserved to die. He doesn't say, I'm more wicked. He's like, no, I'm righteous. She's just more righteous. Like, hey, no harm, no foul. Hey, things happen, water under the bridge. Let's not get hasty and carried away with our reactions here. No one needs to die today. She just did what she had to do. Convenient. And Judah never slept with Tamar again. Now, what does that mean? That means this, that she's going to be the father. She's going to give birth to twins, which kind of ran in the family up the ranks a little bit. She's going to give birth. And here's the deal. Her father-in-law, that's his children, her children. In the name of her first husband, so her first husband who got the double portion of the inheritance, kind of goes back to the guy who would have given it to him, father, to raise with the kids. And how do those kids grow up? Hey, mom, hey, dad/grandpa. I mean, it's all weird. Let's just be real, okay? It's weird. But anyhow, hey, dad, can I visit grandpa? Sure. Spin around. Here I am. How are you? So, weird story. By the way, this is a Bible story, kids, okay? We're going to do this in children's church next week. We're going to have little flannel graphs and tell the story. I mean, do you understand why I wanted to skip it back in the day? But here's the problem. We open the page of the New Testament to start the story of Jesus. And in verse 3, he brings her up. And as soon as you bring up Tamar's name, everyone's like, oh, that story. Oh, yeah. That event. Oh, Judah. Yeah, oh, yeah. You know what I'm saying? So I guess we couldn't skip it too well because it makes a point that apparently God wanted to be pointed out. Now, there are other three women mentioned. I won't spend much time on them because they got their own week already. Matthew 1:5 says, Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. I don't know who Salmon was. Sounds like a fishy guy. But his mother was Rahab. So Rahab was Rahab the what? Harlot, or in the modern translation, Rahab the prostitute. She was also a Canaanite woman. Like Tamar was a Canaanite woman, but just many, 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 many decades or centuries later. And she was not a Jewish girl. She was in Canaan in a very, very, very bad culture, and she was a prostitute at a house of ill repute that she ran. And one day when the spies from Israel were visiting the land, getting ready to come back to the place that where Judah and Tamar once lived, that God had promised them, but they were enslaved in Egypt for a while. As they come back to that land, they know there's going to be wars to fight, so they spy out the land before they come in. And two of the spies are being hunted down by the people who live there. So she hid these two spies in her house. The place she lived was kind of probably a combination of saloon / cheap hotel / house of the night, okay, if you know what I mean. And she was the head of it. And she takes care, she hides these guys. And she says it's because she believes in their God. And she believes that they're going to prevail. And she, because of her faith in that, she helps them. And when they come back and take over the land and they fight that city and people die, they protect her and her family and keep them safe. and she integrates into the life of Israel. And someone says, I want to marry that girl. Maybe it was one of the guys who were staying at her place before. I don't know. I want to marry her. So anyhow, and I'm picturing the parents. Why can't you marry a good Jewish girl, you know? But he marries Rahab the prostitute. And so she's now part of the genealogical record of Jesus. Then we have another. By the way, her story is found in Joshua chapter 2 and Joshua 6, 22 to 25, if you want to read it for yourself later. Then the third woman mentioned in Jesus' genealogy is Matthew 1, 5. Says Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Now, Ruth's story is found in Ruth chapter 1, chapters 1 through 4. And when we told that story, actually, I didn't speak that Sunday. I was gone. Debbie spoke and told that story. So if you want to find that online, she did a great job preaching that message. But here's the story of Ruth in a nutshell without getting into it. She's also not a good Jewish girl. She is a Moabite girl. There was a couple named Elimelech and Naomi who left Israel because there was a famine in the land. And God had told them in those early days, don't leave during hard times. I'll take care of you. But they abandoned that faith in that promise and chased economic security instead. And they moved to Moab. And they had two sons who grew up while they were there. And they married girls from Moab. And then the father dies. And then the two boys die. And now the mother who came there is left with no husband, no sons, just her and her two daughter-in-laws are all widows. And she's devastated. She's going to go back to Israel and just try to beg out a meager existence. Tells the girls to stay behind in their own country and figure their life out. But Ruth says, we're both in trouble. We're going to be in this together. I'm younger and we're able to take care of you. I'm not going to leave you. You're stuck with me. So she goes back to Israel, leaves her country, goes back to Israel to take care of her mother-in-law and figure things out. And while she's there, she's noticed. And she finds a relationship, and she gets married, and she becomes part of the story of the lineage of Jesus. And there's one more name. Matthew 1, verse 6, the fourth woman mentioned. Jesse was the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother was Bathsheba, the widow of Uriah. Again, just naming the name, the story comes to mind, doesn't it? If you know the story, just naming the name. It says the widow of Uriah. You know what's really cringy when I read that? Is actually when David and her first connected, she wasn't the widow of Uriah. Uriah was alive and well at the time. Okay? But David, remember the story? Her men are all out to war. Her husband's a mighty warrior, a famous name in David's army. But David, the king, stays behind one time. Not very typical for him. Well, the men go to war. And she's at her house, which is real near the palace. And she's just waiting and living her life, waiting for her husband to hopefully come back safely. She goes into her backyard, which is closed in with ferns and brush, and it's private, where she could bathe in her yard privately. The problem was David is at the palace, like, unnormally. He walks up on the roof and walks around to look at the city, and he gets a vantage point of her nearby house and can see her bathing. And, of course, he should have just walked away, realized he was invading privacy, but instead, he saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty in the moonlight overtook him. Anyhow, the song, but anyhow. So he sends for her. They bring her in. And he victimizes her. I'm not saying I don't know that she was literally kicking and screaming, but she didn't have a choice. Men brought her. The king was in charge. And he used his power to do what he wanted to do. And she gets pregnant. And he calls her husband back from battle and tries to get him to hook up to cover it up. And he doesn't cooperate, so he sends him back to battle and says, have him murdered on the battlefield. And she loses her husband, and she grieves, and then she's brought to David's harem. She gives birth. The child dies. They grieve. She gives birth again while she is a widow and remarried. And Solomon is born. And these four names are brought up in the lineage of Jesus Christ. Her story, by the way, is found in 2 Samuel 11, 1 through 12, 25, if you want to read it later. And there it is. The family tree of Jesus. Always men, because that's how they did things, right? Except for progressive things. We're going to mention four women. Oh, good. Which four women? Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba. Again, there were dozens of potential names. See, well, some of them, we don't know some of the stories behind some of the other ones. We know Sarah's story, didn't mention Sarah. We know Rebecca's story, didn't mention Rebecca. We know Leah's story, didn't mention Leah. I'm just saying there were other possibilities to mention. And he tells these four names are brought up as a as a point in the reference of the life of Jesus and his pedigree to be the Savior, the King of the Jews. Why? Why them? I say them, I came from a very unhealthy church background where something like this would be said to make it sound like these women were dirty or whatever. They were not. This is not some weird purity goofiness or nothing like that. These women were all wonderful women in terrible circumstances. Three of the four were not Jewish, which would be a rub to a lot of the audience that Jesus ministered to, that Matthew wrote to. He wrote to a Jewish audience who struggled with racial prejudice, and why do you have to bring up these people in the genealogies who aren't even from our country? That was offensive. But also, they all had kind of messy stories. I mean, and not their fault. Tamar, I mean, Judah was the problem there. Rahab, she turned her life around when she came to faith, and Ruth was a rock star, and Bathsheba did nothing wrong but get victimized by a greedy, powerful king. But putting their names in the story, as you read through the genealogies, as soon as you see the name, you go back in your mind to the story. The audience he wrote to would go back in their mind to those stories. You read the other names, and you're like, yeah, that person had that child, and that person had that child, and that person had with her. Oh, that story. Why? Why choose them? Why those stories when there were so many other possibilities? Here's a simple thought I want to share with you, and that is this. He didn't have to choose them. Now, when I say he, I mean God. We believe God inspired the writers to write the story of the scriptures. God, when he had the story written, didn't have to choose them. That means those stories. Stories that happened like that, you know, Judah and Tamar, David and Bathsheba, you know, those stories. He didn't have to choose them. He could have chosen to hide them. Can I be real? We all have some weird people in our family tree somewhere. Okay? You know, and there's people you don't want to talk about somewhere down the line, probably. And maybe that's not so far down the, maybe it's very in the current family tree, there's some weird people. By the way, there's weirdness in every family. If you don't know that, if you're saying, Arlen, there's no one weird in my family, it might be you. It might be you, okay? So anyhow, I'm just saying. But everyone's got someone they're trying to forget about and hide. You just don't talk about, you know, like Michelle, my wife, I said this last service, through her mom's side, they did a genealogy trace. She was in our first service earlier. They did a genealogy trace back to, remember the Mayflower? Thanksgiving, we just had Thanksgiving, landing, Plymouth Rock, 1610 was the year. And who was the first governor of Plymouth Rock Colony? William Bradford, Governor William Bradford. That's my wife's great, 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 great grandpa, okay? So that's the family tree. Now, we tell that story, because I say, hey, I'm related to William Bradford. We don't talk about Uncle Cletus very much, though, you know what I'm saying? Like, we don't mention him. No offense to whoever's name is Cletus here, by the way. I'm just saying, you know, there's always that person in the family tree that you're like, don't mention that story. Jesus is coming into the world. They're writing his story, his pedigree. He didn't have to choose them. He could have chosen to hide them, but he chose to highlight them. He literally puts a spotlight on these sticky stories that make everyone say, oh, right, we're telling the beautiful Christmas story, and here comes the mess. Why would he do that? So that we would know that he's the only one who has to be perfect. This is so important. We're not even to the cross. We're not even to the big messages of Jesus yet. We're in the genealogies in the first six verses, and we're already being reminded that the gospel is good news. That God is saying, check it out here. I know it's messy. It's messy everywhere. I came into a messy world. That's why I'm here. And it's the background. My background comes from a checkered past. By the way, y'all embarrassed by your family? I got some stories too. But that's okay because I'm the one that's, Jesus came to be perfect. He came to live the law that we couldn't live and fulfill the contract of the law, the covenant of the law, and say it is finished one day. It's done. It's obsolete. And new covenant was made. He did all of that because he's the only one that has to be perfect. So here's the bottom line to take home today, and we'll be done. You can write this down if you want to, take a picture, but just think about this week in your devotions, if you would. God can use the most unlikely people and circumstances to bring Christ into the world. That's the story of the Bible all the way through. That's the stories in the books of the Bible. God can use the most unlikely people and circumstances. So if you're sitting here today saying, Arlen, you know, I would love for it to be used by God in some way to do something of spiritual significance in my life. I would love to think that God could do something in my life for the kingdom or through me for the greater good. But I just don't think he could do much because you don't know my past. You don't know what I've done, or you don't know what's been done to me. And so I feel like I'm just not much use. And I'm just saying to you today, here's some good news. God doesn't only come to save sinners like me. He uses us. That God can use the most unlikely people and circumstances, broken people, people who are broken by life. God can use the most unlikely people and circumstances to bring Christ into the world. And that should encourage somebody today. But let me flip that around real quick. When you look at other people, people that you say, oh, that person makes me sick, I don't like them, or they're terrible, or you look down on somebody, maybe you're disgust and judgment, maybe it's pity because of what's happened to them or who they are, and you think that they're of no use. Before you dismiss anybody else around us, remember that it's true for them as well, that God can use the most unlikely people and circumstances to bring Christ into the world. And so maybe we could just walk through the Christian story that we're just entering. We're 6 verses in. We're not going to spend much time, by the way, just so good news. We're not going to spend any more time in the genealogies. We're moving past those. But I wanted to show you how the New Testament starts. We're not even to the action yet. And God's reminding us, before your religion makes you depressed and self-deprecating or makes you judgmental towards others and arrogant, remember that the message of Jesus is supposed to be such good news that it brings us joy and humility and grace for ourselves and others. And God can use the most unlikely people and circumstances to bring Christ into the world. I hope that somewhere today that speaks to you.